On today's episode of Higher Learning, we're joined by Henry Lascali, the Chief People and Culture Officer at the United States Tennis Association. Henry has so much insights to share. He talks about his time working at MTV, being in the media industry, working with a legacy organization like the United States Tennis Association, and how you promote inclusivity and diversity within your own company's culture. Henry is an amazing leader. You're going to love the discussion. I know I loved it. No pun intended. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. Today we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Henry Lascali. He is the Chief People and Culture Officer at the United States Tennis Association. Henry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Oz. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited. I am a big sports fan. Tennis is, you know, it's not my top three, but I follow tennis. I enjoy tennis. We're going to work on that. Maybe by the end of the pod, it's a whole different ballgame.
That's the goal.
No pun intended. But I want to ask this because I'm really interested because you're obviously the head of the USTA. Does every country have its own tennis federation? And how do those global kind of communities work together to advance the global game?
Yeah, that's a great question and a question that comes up quite often. We here at the USTA are the governing body of all things tennis here in the United States. Wimbledon and the association that it works with does something similar in the UK. There's a group that does it in Australia. And of course, for Roland Garros, there's an organization that handles the French growth of the sport.
Awesome. And so you all have like similar agenda incentive, or do you find that sometimes there's different thoughts? Is there a lot of like, you know, back and forth discussions? I'm sure in any group with this much, you know, opportunity and financial impact and people involved, there's got to be some level of discussion, but just how cohesive is it?
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as saying it's cohesive, but certainly lots of conversations that happen amongst the four slams. I will say this, there is a focus on perhaps establishing a premier tour, which would really align all of the many matches you see in the tennis world. And so there are more conversations happening now amongst the four big slams. So we're all focused on one common goal, that is growing the sport globally. We do focus on our local territories, right? The USTA, of course, focusing squarely on what happens here in the US.
Well, let me give you a little bit of commendation as somebody that is a, you know, no sports, but is a little bit of an outsider, but has attended more than a few events. I look at Wimbledon and obviously the court, the tradition, everything that comes with that, awesome. You look at down at Roland Garros and you're looking at the, I believe that's clay, right? They play on clay? Right. So they have that. It's very unique. It looks very different. But when it comes to events, when it comes to the food that you have, the drinks that you have, the pomp, the circumstances in New York, I think the U.S. Open is by far and away one of the best events that we have in all of sports, let alone in tennis. Tell me I'm wrong.
You are 100% right. We've got the Kardashians.
There we go.
We've got winning. Timothée Chalamet and all of these other, you know, trendsetters that descend on the courts for the U.S. Open. So we tend to think of this as much more than a match or a series of matches. This is a lifestyle and one that obviously, we're very, very proud of.
Yeah, I was invited a couple years ago, and I remember there was, I'm forgetting who, but a celebrity chef at the time, and they had like a very specific output that they had, and there was a signature drink, and everybody was in the nines. It's awesome. It's great. It sounds like you played a big part. Your team has played a big part in that. So kudos to what you're doing. I know every year it's going to be better. Just so people, if they're wondering, if they're listening, when is it traditionally held? What time of year again? I'm forgetting.
So typically it starts at the very end of August and it goes through the second week of September.
All right. Well, I'm getting excited. I'm getting into tennis mode right now. So let's start here, Henry. I want to talk about, we're going to get more into tennis, but you spent the majority of your career in what I would call media, right? Traditional and of course on the sports side. How did you get into media? Because I imagine it's even in the HR space, like, this is an industry that people are excited to be a part of. It's hard to get in. It's got to be a lot of competitiveness. Tell me how you broke in.
Thank you. Great question. And I consider myself highly blessed because I've had the privilege of working, as you stated, with some really, really great organizations in the media, entertainment, and more recently in the music and sports spaces. It's curious. I actually started my career in tech. And I was in marketing, in tech, and I realized that it wasn't something that was driving my passion. And I thought maybe it was the marketing or sales element. And then I realized, I think it's more the industry. And so in a very targeted way, I looked at seven companies that were of interest to me. And one of the big companies that I was really enamored with was Viacom. I knew a little bit about Viacom. I knew a little bit about some of the properties, but one in particular really called my attention, and that was, of course, MTV. And so that was really my pathway into media and entertainment.
Okay, so now I got to ask, as a child of the 90s, right, born in 1981, yes. I was a teenager. A lot of my youth and pop culture was informed by Total Request Live and Liquid Television and everything that I used to see on MTV. You were there, you got in there in the heyday, really 93 to 98. So just tell me, a lot of frenzy going on around there. We didn't have as much, there the internet, right? It wasn't like, we're not getting like all these different things all the time. The news was not as like constantly hitting us in the face. Like it was just a different world. It was easier to get kind of like honed in or grow and be a huge entity in something. And very much MTV was kind of leading the way on that from a teenager and pop culture perspective. What was it like to work there? And then how did being there in the early years of your kind of inform the leader that you are now?
Thank you for the very thoughtful question. I got to tell you, it was really the heyday of videos and the immersion of youth meets culture meets music. You mentioned TRL. You know, Carson Daly and Bill Bellamy and Kurt Lauder and all of these other luminaries, right, that were so vibrant in that space. It was a lot of fun. I met a lot of really, really cool people, a lot of people that had an enormous amount of passion for music, passion for journalism, because there was quite a bit of journalism that happened at MTV. They were the authority on music and what was happening, not just in main pop culture, but the subgenres of music. And so it was a really, really interesting time to be there. Those were my formative years in HR. And so it was a baptism by fire, learning some of the things that you shouldn't do, which really informed what I should be and what I should do as a leader today. You know, there were brilliant individuals that worked at MTV, but sometimes the things they did were, you know, just absolutely crazy. Of course, I couldn't get into it here in this podcast,
yeah,
but.
And of course, you're HR, so you've got to deal with the cause and effect of that and the outputs and yeah.
1,000%, brother, 1,000%. So it was an interesting time to be there. It was an interesting period of growth in terms of what the company was doing, how it was organizing itself. It was also the advent of the internet. At that point in time, there was no YouTube. MTV was really YouTube. MTV is where you went to, you know, watch that video for the first time. And so it was interesting how the organization began wrapping its arms and strategy around new media, right? So it was a great time to be in HR, lots of learning. I also recognized how different you need to lead a group of creatives versus a group of technologists. Mm-hmm. So as a leader, I came to appreciate that there isn't one size fits all. Different people need very different things to energize them, to stimulate their creativity, to help them be the best version of themselves in the context of work. The other interesting thing that I learned at that period of time was that what motivates me might not motivate you. What motivates you may not motivate me. And so coming to appreciate that it's not always about money. Oftentimes it's about growth. Oftentimes it's about just the interesting nature of the projects that we might be given. So I left MTV Networks feeling that I had stretched quite a bit as a person, as a leader, and certainly as an HR practitioner.
One thing that a couple comments I'll make. So the first thing that you said that really stands out to me is leading technologists versus creatives. And one thing that I've had to understand in my role is that, we have our marketing team. We have a UI UX team for building our software. Creatives, the more you try to put them in a box and provide rigidity, you kind of stifle a lot of the time what makes them great, whether it be the work hours, whether it be the office setting, whether it be the tools they can use. And so you learn these types of things. You can't have these. It's not that you can't have the same standards. There's got to be a baseline of values and culture and standards that you have. But at the same time, if you're taking the same cookie cutter approach of management, leadership, policy, whatever it is, to everybody in the organization, then sometimes you're going to run into, you know, potential issues, right? So I think that's a really good call out on your part. You deal with some of the downsides, but then you love some of the upsides and what that can lead to from an innovation perspective, from an artistic perspective. So certainly a great call out, something good to have early in your career, especially with the juxtaposition of the technology experience and then having that kind of creative experience. And then, you know, I don't think my wife has listened to a full episode of this podcast, but she would be mad at me if I didn't bring up Real World, Road Rules, Road Rules, Real World Challenge, which we've watched every year since we dated and we're married. The Grind, like we talked about, Total Request Live, MTV Music Awards, so many of those things. It's just funny how I wonder if anything will ever have that level of impact from a music perspective where it was also centralized, right? Much like ESPN was for sports back in the day, right? Same thing with MTV, that it was just this hub. And to your point, like, I would actually be like running to the TV to see the debut of a new music video. And if I caught one, like, halfway in, like, oh man, I gotta wait again to wait till it comes up. It's just so weird how we live in this instantaneous world now where I can click and watch anything I want at time. It's just funny how we took in a lot of stuff. So I think that was very great explanation on your part. I love that you were there. Got to share a little nostalgia for me. So I'm done with my selfish motivation. Glad we could talk about that. Thank you for sharing what you did. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that you took on this chief people and culture officer role, which I think is not often that you see the culture role being part of the title. Or being that singled out. I think sometimes it's just presumed as part of the chief people officer. So I'm very interested on why the title of that role, why was that important for you? Was that something you asked for, or was that something that they came to you with and said, this is part of the role? Like, I'm interested in the dynamic of that being part of the title.
They actually came to me with that title. And I, like you, was very moved that an organization of this size, of this importance, that's been around as long as this organization has been around, would double down on the notion of re-energizing culture. I'm not a believer, by the way, that culture is necessarily made. I think you spark things in culture, in the environment, that ultimately shift it and add a new energy to it, a new dimension to it. So, I'm a big believer that if you do a lot of little things right, you create this movement, you create this shift, you create the static electricity, right, in the culture. And so the chairman of the USTA was very intentional about wanting to create a workplace experience that really speaks to our values as an organization, that really speaks to not just what we are, but what we aspire to be. And so he was very intentional about finding someone who had a blended experience. You know, all of the mechanical HR stuff, yes, absolutely needed to have. But more critically, he was looking for someone that could really help articulate what good culture looks like, what good culture could be, and ultimately bring some of that spark to make it happen. And so the title wasn't something I asked for. It's a title I'm blessed to have, but it was a title that the organization felt they needed to have.
Mm. I love that. And let's talk a little bit about that legacy, because you're right. This isn't MTV, which I think was like 1981, video killed the radio star and everything went from there. This is 1881, okay? So you've got to bring some best practices and electricity around culture in something so tradition-laden, something that's got a lot of legacy, right? That's a big lift, it feels like. Tell me about why that was exciting for you as a challenge and maybe what you've done since you've gotten there to kind of bring that energy.
Thank you for the question. And you know, I will say modestly, it takes a village, and I have an incredible people and culture team that's supporting this strategy. We've got an incredible senior leadership team that also has philosophically and practically done things to help support this cultural evolution. You are absolutely right. We've been around since 1881. Our mission, our goal, again, beyond growing the sport of tennis, it's really to inspire healthier communities everywhere by way of tennis. How do you turn that mission and that focus internally so that it's not just what we're saying on the outside, but really what we're living on the inside of the organization? And so our cultural strategy began with that purpose, right? What do we aspire to be? What do we aspire our employees to feel? I read this quote that, you know, really resonated with me. Oz, knowing what I know about you, I'm sure it's going to resonate with you. Culture is what your employees feel on Sunday night when they think about work.
Ooh. So the opposite of Sunday scaries, or that is your culture if they have the Sunday scaries.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So to me, that was almost the North Star. What do I want to feel? What do I want our employees to feel on Sunday night when they think about work? I believe a critical measure is engagement, right? If I can do things, if my team can do things, if our leadership team can do things that generate a sense of engagement, not only do you avoid the Sunday scaries, but you also have an employee that's more motivated, that's more insightful, that's more creative, ultimately more productive. We've even done research on the correlation between engagement and the cost of benefits. So the research indicates that the more engaged an employee is, the less sick they are. And when they are sick, the severity of it is more limited, right? So if we create well-being, first and foremost, aligned with our value, aligned with our mission, we can then generate engagement. Once we have engagement, we're starting to electrify the culture, right? So engagement isn't the one thing that one person does, right? Engagement is that spirit that everyone's feeling that then collectively lifts up the culture.
Yeah, I love that. You're right. That quote's amazing. It's something I'll continue to think about. One of the things that stands out to me is I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a founder. I know a lot of entrepreneurs. You know, I'm not saying that like on Friday when I get out, I'm like, oh, shucks, it's the weekend. I got to hang out with my family. That's not the case. But I will tell you, I am chomping on the bit on Sunday night and I'm ready to get to work. And it's like I got a football game the next day and I'm ready to run through that banner. But the thing is, it's probably natural for me to feel that way, right? In a lot of ways, this is my baby. This is something that I've spent a lot of time on. I've tried to create an environment, right, that is one that I enjoy going to work, and I know that that trickles down to the team. But it's so important that the employees feel that way. It's easy for me to feel that way. It's probably natural for me to feel that way. It's funny because I hear founders and entrepreneurs talk about, you know, they don't care as much as I do, or they don't have that. Well, yeah, no duh. Like, you get that? Like, that you have to build that. Like, that's not something that's going to just be there because you feel that way. They're going to feel that way too. So I do think it's important about being intentional. And we were just talking about this earlier. Like, we're moving into a new office pretty soon. We want to create a physical space, right, that, you know, listen, let's not trick ourselves, right? If somebody's dead set about not ever going back in office, there's no office that's going to make them feel great about going into it. But you can create an environment where they feel like they're productive, they feel like they can collaborate, they feel like they can be part of the culture, and they can get value and benefit out of that. And that's just one small way that you can kind of shift a culture or build a culture. And so being intentional like that is really important. I agree with you. I want this to be an environment where you don't wake up and you dread going to work, right? That doesn't mean there's all puppy dogs and lollipops. There's challenges for sure. But at the end of the day, if you're fighting those challenges with people that you respect, you like, and you feel empowered, and you feel like there's leadership and management that's investing in you and taking care of, you're going to feel pretty good about that culture. So I think that's a really good barometer and something I'll continue to think about. Tennis, turns out, is one of the most diverse sports, and on the court in particular, right? Think of just some of the stars and the different countries that they come from. We've had Serena and Venus Williams here in the U.S., right? You have from all different countries, some of the greatest stars, are there on the court. I don't really know that I've thought of it outside of that. Tennis as a diverse sport, though, mostly because I feel like there's, you know, if I think of Wimbledon and I think of some of these different things, it's a very prim and proper and very affluent sport, and there's gates to get into it. So I'm just interested, like, as we look at that, 62% of the growth in the sport, right, has been women and people of color. So I'm just interested, as you're looking to energize this culture at USTA, how do you highlight that growth and be inclusive around those, building those healthier communities everywhere within your organization, but also that's representative of what we're seeing on the court with USTA, and global tennis in general?
Yeah, Oz, what you just presented, I think, is a perception that many individuals have about tennis. It is an inclusive, a very exclusive club that's not inclusive, right? In every sense of the word, it's expensive. It's very country club oriented, right? And it's candidly very white. That is the perception that many have of tennis. What we're seeing, as you well articulated, is this incredible swell, this incredible growth, particularly younger people, particularly people of color. Latinos, in fact, are the group that's heading that growth. You articulated females, which is absolutely true. So the growth that we are enjoying really contradicts all of those perceptions of the sport. We do recognize that tennis is one of the healthiest sports. In fact, our studies show that individuals that play tennis are healthier mentally, physically, even financially. And so when we think about the communities that would most benefit from tennis, we're looking at some of these underserved communities, you know, in the United States. And so we're being very, very intentional about really introducing the game, right? Facilitating the game to these communities that would benefit most from it. We're doing it not simply because we want to grow the sport. In fact, that's secondary to the fact that our mission is to create healthier communities, right? And so that is a huge, huge driver for us. So again, to your question, when we shine that spotlight internally, it is absolutely my remit to make sure that our organization looks like the growth trajectory that we're enjoying in tennis. Hmm. Our internal demographics should mirror what the world looks like, what the United States demography looks like. And so, again, we're very, very intentional about making sure that we have the right composition of staff that's representative, that is inclusive, that speaks to how the world is changing and how we can best respond to this changing world.
I love that. What an answer. How exciting. What a great time to be part of tennis. And it sounds like there's some amazing things going on internally, just like what we're seeing out on the court. I got to ask, I don't know if you're allowed to answer this. Do you have a favorite historical player and a favorite current player that you'd bring up to us that you follow more often than that? Or are you allowed to answer
that? Wow. It's difficult to answer because so many of these incredible athletes, right, are part of the fabric of what the USTA is. You know,
obviously, we don't want to show any favoritism.
I'm going to say Serena, because Serena, in our minds, changed the sport in so many significant ways. Of course, you have a Billie Jean King who not just played the game well, but truly changed the face of the sport. And I might even say changed the face of sports, right? Equal pay for women. I mean, that is historic. That is an epic thing that really change sports forever. Great. And so, I mean, there's so many luminaries. You know, it'd be hard for me to pick.
I'll answer the question myself because I don't have any issues. I will say that I grew up and I loved Andre Agassi because he was, yes. I'm from the West Coast. He was in Vegas, right? He ultimately had those cool commercials. He had the long hair, then the shaved head. He was just, he had a bunch of swag. And so I remember I liked his style of play. And so when I was growing up, that's probably who I followed the most. I had a lot of respect for guys like Sampras, right? Obviously, Federer is amazing, but I love the personality. I guess to a degree, I kind of like McEnroe too, because it's just so fiery and stuff like that. You love to see it on the court. So tons of great tennis players out there right now currently. Yes. But I look back at some of those historical ones, and those are the ones that I really, you know, I felt simpatico with. So
Yes.
All right, now I got to ask you, this is a personal curiosity of mine. I, like many people over the last few years, been like, what the hell is this pickleball thing? And like, why is it picking up so much, right? You see, like, I think Tom Brady invested in professional pickleball. I'm seeing it on TV. I've got friends who are playing it. I've got grandparents that I know that are playing it. I'm just interested. This is one of the fastest growing sports in my recent memory. I'm interested how the USTA looks at the rise of the sport. Do you see this as being good for tennis growth?
In a sense, it aligns with our mission, right? Because playing pickleball does inspire healthier communities, right? So in that sense, it aligns with our mission. Do we see it as a competitive sport? Not directly. I will say, though, one of the challenges that we are looking to address is the fact that some of our courts are now being cannibalized or pickleball, right? Mm-hmm. The courts are being made shorter and you know, aligned more for the pickleball sport. We see it as something you do in adjacency with tennis, not something that you do instead of tennis. We see pickleball as being a sport that could potentially lead many younger folks and folks that haven't played tennis into the tennis ecosystem. So we definitely are keeping an eye on it. We think there's great opportunity with pickleball. It is, as you stated, an emerging sport. There's a lot of pop culture discussion around pickleball. In fact, it's a viral sport, right? You're reading, you know, lots of tweets about it. In fact, I just watched some show where, you know, they went and they played pickleball, and I thought, isn't that interesting, you know? So people are playing pickleball, yes, but I will say this, people want to live the tennis lifestyle.
Oof, true. I agree. I don't want to live a pickleball lifestyle. I have a different perspective of what that is versus right? tennis. And here's what I'll say.
You don't live it.
Exactly. I don't know that everybody will know this analogy, but if you like football or soccer, there's something called futsal that they play in Brazil, which is a smaller court, less players, smaller ball. Like it's like, you know, and so to me, I look at pickleball and soccer, right? I look at tennis and soccer and then futsal and pickleball as kind of similar, or maybe arena football versus NFL football. Listen, at the end of the day, pickleball, and this is just me, I'm speaking, I might make myself a hater now in terms of all the pickleball fans out there. Give me tennis. I'm sticking with the old traditions. I'm sticking with 1881. I'm sticking with Agassi and Sampras. I couldn't name a pickleball player if my life depended on it. So good luck. I hope the sport grows. It's interesting. I'm glad people are getting out there and getting exercise, but come on. It's not tennis.
Thank you for the solidarity, brother.
I'm with you, man. Hey, listen, I know my audience. If I had a professional pickleball player here, I don't want to say I'm being disingenuous, but got to play to your audience. I probably wouldn't say anything. All right. We got to pay our bills here. And one of the things that we do on this show is we talk about hiring. We're obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with it. I love to talk to people who have done tons of hiring throughout their career. I want to find out what makes them great at hiring. So we're going to ask you some questions, get some ideas and thoughts as somebody who's done a lot of hiring, both for yourself and for your organization throughout your career. So first question, if I had to ask you, do you got like a core hiring philosophy? What comes to mind when I ask you that?
Good question. I would say my personal hiring philosophy, hire for what they can do versus what they have done.
Expound on that. Let me ask it a different way real quickly. How in an interview do you think you can identify that? Because we have such limited time to try to assess and identify the right fits. Do you have any specific things that you do in the interview to try to develop, understand their potential versus what their resume says?
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, using that behaviorally targeted set of questions, right? Where you explore how the person thinks, you explore how the person reacts to things, you explore some of the things that they've actually done that speak to how they frame the world in general, right? And Oz, if I may, just to elaborate further on that, I tend to think that we've evolved from a specialist society to more of a generalist society, right? Where you have folks that can cover, you know, multiple functions thoughtfully, right? They may have more precision, more acuity with one of the functions, but they're just broader, right? They're more of a generalist, right? And so I think as companies shift, as the organizational models shift and evolve, I think that's also something that we need, right? So I refer to it as the generalist competency, right? Where you can be really, really good at one thing, but not necessarily be limited to that one thing. So in short, right, my personal philosophy is higher based on what the person can evolve to do versus simply what you need here and now.
Fantastic. There's a book called Range. Have you heard of it?
I haven't. I will look it up though.
I demand you pick that up on Amazon. You will love it. It speaks exactly to what you're saying. And listen, Jackie, I don't think I really hit it out of the park with my last analogy on futsal, football. So we're going to try again. In the book Range, one of the things that they talk about at the beginning, and this is very relevant, professional podcast host coming out here, they talk about Tiger Woods, okay? And how we look at what he did to become the greatest golfer, if not one of the greatest golfers of all time, depending on where you're sitting. And that he was so maniacally focused on just golf, and his dad very famously, like very much, you know, born and bred him to be a great professional golfer, okay? And that a lot of times we look at those situations and it's like that 10,000 hours, you know, allegory that Malcolm Gladwell has brought up of spending so much time on something to become an expert. But this book Range, which Malcolm Gladwell actually also opines on and says he agrees with in a lot of ways, uses Roger Federer as a counterpoint and example, and the more likely hood of great success. And what they talked about with Federer is even though his parents were tennis coaches, I believe, they actually pushed him away from just focusing on tennis. They had him play multiple different sports. I think he did some sort of dancing or ballet, things like that, which ultimately famously have made his feet on the court, his ability, his ambidextrous nature, his skills quite a bit more honed than if he just would have focused on tennis. And his parents as coaches knowingly did that. And so the entire theme of the book, even though they start off with this example, is exactly what you said. This idea of getting a multitude of experience, you know, that used to be said a jack of all trades in kind of a negative way, but I agree with you. I think we're moving out of this specialization world and we're moving to more of a, how many things can you do well, right? And that way you can cover a lot more ground. And not only that, what worked for you in A can be attributed over to B to get a great outcome. So I think you're spot on with that. I think you really, really found something. Check out that book. I don't know if I have it behind me here or not, but definitely worth reading. And it was recommended to me by somebody at a VC. So it comes from high recommendation. So I think you'll really like that book. If I ask you about a memorable interview experience, either one you were sitting in as the person interviewing or you were being interviewed, what comes to mind when I ask you about that?
Oh, great question. I remember interviewing someone. This was while I was at Time Inc. I headed up the HR organization for the revenue generating staff. So think salespeople, the sponsorship people, that side of the publishing enterprise. And we were looking for a senior person that can handle a couple of categories. I think it may have been InStyle. Yeah, I think it was InStyle. And so it was a senior person for InStyle. And the woman sitting across from me was from a much, much smaller publication. In fact, it was a publication that we wouldn't naturally source from because just the volume of business was so much smaller, right? Much more conservative than what you would have seen at an InStyle. And this woman had so much charisma, so much energy, a hunger that, you know, I hadn't really seen in a lot of other folks. And, you know, Oz, I stepped outside of my recruiter role and actually was a sponsor for this candidate. And, you know, long story short, she is hired by InStyle. Long story short, she subsequently becomes an ad director. She subsequently becomes a publisher. And so, you know, I share this with you because this was a person of color. This was a person who, you know, again, stood out, not necessarily by virtue of where she was. She stood out by virtue of her intellectual curiosity, her energy, her drive, her ambition, right? And so it's one of those stories that stand out. And certainly I don't take credit for her success, but I had a little something to do, right, with positioning her in the right place at the right time at a brand that was just on fire at that moment in time.
Brother, you're preaching the gospel on this. I actually do think you should take, you know, responsibility, but you should feel proud of your what you did to contribute to this person's success. And they should feel that way, because here's the way I look at it, especially in talent acquisition. One of the things why I got into this space and why I fell into it, but felt like there was opportunity, was because, you know, I'm not going to put us up at the level of doctors, nurses, firemen, policemen, you know, people who are really giving back to the community in a really big way. My gosh, I put us right down in that tier right below, because when you help somebody find that perfect job, that new manager, that career opportunity, maybe they were laid off, maybe they were in a toxic situation, you're doing a great service. You're doing a great service for the company, but you're doing a great service for that individual. And like, one of the few things I learned in recruiting really early on after I got out of technology was that ultimately the people after a year or two would come back to me, and the things that they would say about how I had actually helped impact their life, where they could send their kids to private school now, or we relocated them to a place that they really loved, or, you know, they've been promoted multiple different times. Like, that's important. And quite frankly, without your intervention, that may not have happened. So I kudos to you on that. I was going to ask you about the best hire you've ever made, but I think you already answered it. That's an awesome story. Thank you so much for sharing it. What about, do you have a favorite question you like to go to in the interview sessions?
Yeah, absolutely. If you could do anything, what would that anything be?
I like that. What kind of answer are you looking for with that?
Yeah. So again, it helps me appreciate, based on how they answer, right? If they answer strictly in the context of the work frame, that tells me something about the person. If they speak outside of that, it also says something about the person. What I'm looking to understand is directionally, where do they want their life to be, right? And there are some positions that I think offer more of a complement to what that person is looking for. I'm a firm believer, Oz, and I'm sure you are, right? Someone who specializes in talent acquisition, that anyone can do anything for a short period of time. But if it isn't the right fit, they're going to burn out. Something's not going to go well, right? And so, you know, I always like to align what I hear from that answer with the actual role. Because if you get the insight from that person and you have a good sense of where they want to be, that answer helps educate a really good placement in the organization.
Love that. All right. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast before, but if not, shame on you. Many times what we do is we flip the question back on you and me. So we're going to ask you, Henry, how would you answer that question? What would you be doing if you could be doing anything?
I'd have a podcast.
Oh, wow. Lucky you.
No.
Let's see. I see myself as being this mix of culture, engagement, data, right? So the notion of teaching sits well with me, right? So I think of myself as a teacher even now, right? But I could see myself teaching, you know, like a college professor somewhere in a tweed jacket, you know, with like, anyway, I think that's what I'd be doing probably. I'd be teaching somewhere. And I think I have a book in me too, Oz. Since you asked the question, right? And I'm
this is why it's provocative. This is what we want to talk about. We want to learn about you. What's going on? And listen, I think it translates a lot to what you're doing. There's obviously a lot of coaching and guidance and documentation and best practices that are very much informed with teaching and writing a book. So I love that. When you first said podcast, I'm like, hey man, everybody's got a podcast. They even gave me a podcast. So that's not, you're not striving hard enough. So I'm glad that that was not the real answer. I'm going to answer the question how I would answer it.
Yes.
And then I'm going to attribute it to the role I have because you said that was important. So I want to make sure I do that. So if I could be doing anything, I would be owning a professional NBA team. Could be NFL, could be soccer, but that's what I would want. I would want to own a professional sports team. But here's why. Here's how this translates. And that's why this is still my goal and why I'm building towards this. I want to take the two things I'm most passionate about in life, outside of my family, outside of my friends and all that good stuff. Sports and talent. And I want to combine these two things to build an organization with great culture, with great drafting ability, with great development ability, and have the ultimate scoreboard of ones and zeros, wins and losses, right? Because business can be subjective sometimes, right? And take my philosophy and beliefs on how you draft and develop talent and what people are missing across all professional sports and see if my theories and my theses prove out with the ultimate banners hanging from the ceilings or the championships. And so it's combining the things that I love. I'm doing one half of it right now with companies and businesses. I'm lucky enough to work with companies like the NBA and other big sports organizations, the PGA we worked with in the past. But I want to combine it by having kind of full control of taking and building what I believe is a talent-centric organization that knows how to cultivate and develop talent unlike any sports organization ever has done. That would be my dream. Would you hire me?
Yes, like that fast, great answer.
Thank you, buddy.
Great answer.
And I didn't know you were bringing that, so that was off the cuff. Hopefully it worked out. All right, listen. When you're creating an experience for the candidates to help them understand what's it like to work at the USTA, right? They come in. You want them to know, yeah, there's things that you see on TV, but like, here's the nitty gritty. Here's what it's really like to work here. Here's what we're trying to do. How do you inform that in the interview experience? Is there anything around just being upfront about it and candid about it? Do you share things? Is there content? Do you have them talk to a diverse group of people so they can get different points of view? Help me understand how a candidate going through a full process with your organization would walk out knowing a realistic job preview. I know what this is going to be like when I take this role.
So us to us, that's the distinction between just having an interview and what we consider the candidate experience, right? I want to create fans of the USTA.
Smart.
Right? Whether we interview you or not, whether we hire you or not, I want that candidate experience to be so rich, so vibrant, that you walk away a fan and hopefully an ambassador of the USTA. And so our recruiters are very, very good at not only sending you a pre-video of what the USTA is, but they walk you through this narrative of what the association is historically, what we've done, what we mean to tennis, what we mean to the world, right? And how they can be a part of that magic, right? So it's not just interviewing, it's creating this narrative, right? This cultural arc that helps them appreciate where they can be and how they can be a part of it, right? So it's the experience versus the interview. And that's what we try and create.
Jackie, we need to get a buzzer for when I get the best damn answer for a question I've ever gotten. That was the best answer I've ever gotten to that. See, I'm glad. You're very intentional about it. Most people, they don't answer it like that. They usually take it in a different direction. So I'm very appreciative of that. And I think that's so important. And I think you said something really, really key. I've always told some of our customers and clients that I think one of the most underrated forms of marketing is going to be, especially if you're a big organization, is how you handle candidates that are in your pipe, in your process. Because here's what happens at the end of the day. Their experience interviewing with you is going to inform a few different things. If they ever want to work there, if they would tell their friends they ever work there, and a lot of times if they ever want to use your products and services. So I think it's a very smart thing to win tennis fans every time they go into your process and pipeline, and there's small little things you can do to create that and curate that experience in a way that's exceptional. So kudos to you. You're on top of it. Your team's on top of it. Very, very good stuff. I appreciate that answer quite a bit. When you miss on somebody, because we all miss, do you look back on maybe a theme of something you should have done differently or something that do you have like a bias that comes up from time to time that you have to kind of mitigate? Or?
Yeah, it's interesting. And Oz, I should have said this at the onset. I've been with the association about 15 months now. So I still consider myself relatively new to the organization.
Sure.
We've made, I think, great strides in this time. The team has done incredible work. But there are a couple of misses. And one of the things that, I certainly see here, it's something I've seen in other, organizations where, I've had the privilege of leading the HR organization for. And that is, sometimes the communication fails. Sometimes it just breaks in the process, right? We're interviewing someone, we're excited about the person. And then there's someone else that comes along, and that's the person we end up hiring. And then our focus just completely pivots from, the one we thought we were going to hire to the person we ultimately hired. And for this person, right, the experience then becomes diminished. So
recency bias too, though, right? Like maybe you're just looking at the new thing that happened and forgetting the great interview 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
100% recency bias, but sometimes just being candid, it's a communication fail. Sometimes we just miss it, right? And it's not that we don't get back to the candidate. Of course we do. But is it with the right timeline, right? And again, you hit the nail on the head, right? We want people to be excited to speak well of the USTA, particularly with so much social media. I know, for example, that 76% of job candidates are looking at what their peers are saying about an organization, right? So if we don't get it right, it's not that it's a fail relative to that one candidate. Oz, it's a fail for their entire network of contacts, right? So the communication piece becomes critically important. The communication piece, again, the branding piece serves as a very powerful way of articulating what a great employer the USTA can be. So it doesn't happen often, but when there is that communication fail, I take it hard.
Yeah. Listen, it's a very natural thing. I mean, you interviewed the person 2 weeks ago. Your eye level was here. This is great. You're giving them the buying signs. They're feeling good.
Yeah.
And then your eye level gets changed. And it doesn't mean that what you were doing in that moment was wrong. Your intention was obviously good, but things do change. It's an evolving process a lot of the time. How do you handle that? I think you articulated that beautifully. The fact that you're thinking about it and intentional about it tells me you probably do a pretty dang good job of it. It's something for other companies to think about too. How do we make sure that we think of that experience as important? That doesn't mean you need to hire everybody, certainly not, but you can create a great experience for everybody. That I know. And the power of that is pretty underrated in my opinion. Last hiring question, is there any technology you use that helps you hire? Are you kind of a Excel or maybe a chicken scratch on a piece of paper? Anything you do in the hiring process technology-wise that excites you, or is it lacking in that space for you?
Yeah, we use, we have a system, iSIMS. I don't know if you're familiar with iSIMS.
I'm more than familiar with it.
So we use iSIMS here at the USTA. It's integrated with our other technologies, right? It allows us to post. It allows us to push out postings. We are able to correspond with candidates, which again, as you beautifully stated, is such an important part of this process, right? Being able to stay in touch with candidates, having that talent community, right, from which we can draw, individuals that may have been passive at one point, right, but may be more engaged now for a job search. So we have that platform. It works well for us. We are looking at, really growing our social media presence. So we've been doing a lot more in that space. We've been doing a lot more SEO, right? We want as many people seeing our career site as possible. And so we've been doing a lot of very intentional work in that space because we want to make sure that, you know, you think about us first when you think about a job in tennis, but my aspiration is you think of us first, period, when you're thinking about a job in sports.
That's a big goal. I love that. Shoot for the stars. I like that.
That's the aspiration.
I love the aspiration. Let's talk a little bit about some things outside of kind of the hiring side, but related to you, your work. Is there anything you're working on right now that you're just like really juiced about? You're super pumped about? Maybe Sunday night, you're ready to get to work because you're excited to work on X.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you for asking that. So I've been doing a lot of homework on the brain, right? And the reason why is I found this bit of research that suggests that our brain reacts to a new job the same way the brain reacts to different moments of stress. Mm. So that is to say, when you are hired into a company, the fight flight response is in full swing.
Wow.
So why does that matter to me? Why should that matter to anyone in HR?
I think I know the answer, but I can't wait to hear it. Let's hear it.
Yeah. Think about onboarding, right? Uh-huh. We literally, right, drown new hires with information. And yet, Oz, only 20% of what you are being taught, 20% of that data actually stays with you, right? And if you think about, you know, the last time you started a job, you probably couldn't even remember people's names, right? Why is that? Well, your brain is actually working against you, right? During those first few weeks, you are uncomfortable. You don't have a sense of belonging. You're questioning, in fact, second guessing whether you made the right decision to leave the previous employer. Even if you come to the conclusion that you made the right decision, you're still not sure if this was the right employment decision. Mm-hmm. That's what your brain is doing, right? And so this is completely altering and shifting our onboarding process, mm-hmm. right? We're changing how we orient. We're changing how we schedule, right? And how long training periods are, you know, for new hires. So it's changing that for us. And so I'm really jazzed about the work we're doing in that space. I think it will be revolutionary. I think it'll be a very, very different model of onboarding from what we certainly have traditionally had. But based on what I'm seeing, it'll be very different from what most organizations have.
So I love this. And Jackie's over here smiling because we have a C-level person starting in a newly created role, really important for our company. It starts Monday. He's going to be working out of our New York office, okay? But we're flying him down here to our corporate office in South Florida. We've flown in people from other different offices. A lot of my directs are going to be here. And I went through I was very diligent around the hiring process and baselining and references and case studies and everything I could do from that perspective. But also I took the onboarding, and we took the onboarding super seriously here. So we put together a 6-week program that exposes this person to every bit of the company. We have a buddy system for him. Here's what we're doing on Monday. This is not normal, but comes in, we do our Monday morning meeting in front of the entire company. We're going to introduce, find out a little bit about him personally. Then we're going to break out into groups, go into some training sessions for him, give him some real world experience. Then at 4:30, we are starting a competition of 5 events where we're putting people into teams. Don't tell him, he's going to be on my team. We'll see how that goes. Okay. We're going to have a little competitiveness because that's something our organization loves and thrives on, and teams going together, broken up into little segments. So we're going to do that. Then we're going to head out to a team dinner at a restaurant down here in South Florida that's pretty lively and has great food and drinks. And that's just his first day. And so he's definitely going to be a little bit exhausted. But what I want, and the whole thing I was thinking about, was I want him to know within 24 hours. I absolutely made the right decision to come to this company. I like the people I work with. I like the amount of, you know, focus on balance of what we're doing. And then on Tuesday, we're having a team lunch where we're bringing everybody together and going out to a nice restaurant. And then on Wednesday, we've got activities planned too. So is it going to work? I don't know. Coming soon. I'll get back to you. Stay tuned. Okay. But definitely a lot of intention. And I didn't know what you said about the fight or flight, but that makes a lot of sense, right? It's like going to a new school. It's like anything you do, there's a little bit of like, you're constantly looking subconsciously and consciously for signs that you did the right thing. And if you get enough data points that say no, that's really going to inform your tenure and engagement going forward. And that's why they talk about how that first 2 to 4 weeks of starting a new job, if you manage that properly, how much that cuts back on attrition. So super interested to have follow-up with you. Hopefully we can get together and in person have a drink at some point and you can share some of these things and how they're going, because I totally believe in what you said. And I think you're doing some really good stuff there. So I can't wait to find out more about it. Thank you for sharing. That's awesome. I want to ask you, you have a great book you read recently or any content you've seen recently that you want to recommend for our listeners?
Atomic Habits.
James Clear. Great book. Not goals, build systems.
I mean, I think that book is like a life changer. I think the just the methodology, right, and the understanding of how the brain works, right, because it's really all about the brain. Just complete side note, love the book, but I want to just commend you. That onboarding program that you've developed for this new hire is exactly the right thing, in that the more socialization you can create, you accelerate the sense of belonging. The sense of belonging is what turns off the fight flight. So everything you're doing generates that sense of community. So well done.
That means a lot coming from you, from somebody who studied this and thought a lot about it and leading it at your company. That means a lot to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Atomic Habits, great book. Read it a few times. In fact, every couple of years, I pick it back up. What's funny is, I remember, I think, I don't know if it was the first time I read it, but it was very early on, right when COVID started. I remember that I read the book and I remember thinking in my head a couple of things. One is, you know what? I was probably not in the shape that I wanted to be in, but I would tell people all the time, oh, you should have seen me in college. I'll get back there. Don't worry. People must have been like, dude, you're like 38. Chill out. That's not happening anymore, right? I was probably stressed out and I was casually smoking cigarettes. Not like a pack a day or anything like that, but I was casually doing that. And I kind of made the decision, all right, if I'm going to get in shape, then I'm never going to have more control of my schedule and my diet than I do right now, right? I'm never going to have to, if I'm going to do this cold turkey, it's never going to happen to now. And I remember reading that book and it informed me at the time, don't set a goal to run a certain amount of miles. Don't do these things. Build systems that make it easy and take away the friction to allow you to do the things. Like, don't put yourself in the wrong environments. Have a time of day where you do it. I did that. Would you know it? I ran, I think it was, I measured it like 280 days in a row, 3 miles. I lost like 60 pounds. I achieved a lot of goals, but it was only because of the systems. And that book at that time really, really helped me kind of think through that. So I love that recommendation. If we have anybody who hasn't read that, I would highly recommend picking it up myself. Great one. Last question. Henry, we're thinking back to the MTV days. We're thinking back to 20-year-old Henry. If you had to give yourself one bit of advice that you didn't know then, but you know now, what would it be?
Great question. You have a voice, be comfortable using it. That advice would have been so meaningful, you know, as a person of color, right? Sometimes you are more comfortable blending into the background, right? And considering the opinions of others to be much more important and more weighty than anything you could possibly offer. And I know that, you know, through my career, right, there have been those moments where I probably should have said something. I should have spoken up. I should have had more of a voice. And so if I can go back in time and speak to, you know, the thinner 20-year-old Henry, I probably would say that to him. You know, you have a voice, you have intellect, Don't be afraid to say what you think.
I love that. And with that newfound voice, you should have a hit podcast coming soon. I can't wait to listen to it when it starts. Henry, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining. Looking forward to everybody getting a listen on this episode. Can't wait to talk to you again.
Me too, Oz. Thank you so much for having me today. It's been great.
Thanks, bud.